You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Prince and the Predator by Mark Seal. More dangerous than the tabloid reporter outside of Epstein's mansion, however, was the predator inside. At this moment, Epstein was a year and a half out from serving 13 months in a Palm Beach, Florida jail, with time free on work release, after pleading guilty to two charges, including soliciting a minor for prostitution. It would be 9 long years before he was arrested again on July 6, 2019, and charged with sex trafficking, and the horrors of his sordid world and scores of underage victims began to come fully to light. He would be found dead in his jail cell 1 month after his arrest, presumably by suicide. But on this December day in 2010, he was a free man with a prince as his house guest. In Andrew, Epstein had found his Super Bowl trophy, says Epstein's former business associate Stephen Hoffenberg, who received a 20-year prison sentence in 1997 for running a $460 million Ponzi scheme. In order to get ahead of all of his monstrous misconduct, Epstein had to have a national security plan that would embarrass countries and their national security. He felt this would shield him from prosecution. He bragged about this. And Prince Andrew was a vital part of England and other countries and could open many doors. With Andrew, Epstein had a precise plan. Was that plan bigger than Andrew? Could he have merely been a pawn on the path to the motherlode, the fortune estimated at $28 billion of the royal family itself? How bold is Jeffrey Epstein? Asked the friend of Andrew's. Bold enough, the source imagines, to target the Queen's favorite son in hopes of placing him in a compromising situation with the intention of someday using the evidence against Andrew, or even, he adds, taking down who I believe was Epstein's real mark, Her Majesty the Queen of England. Epstein could say, "What can I do with this little mouse in the cage before I eat him? Can he provide access? He's going to tie a little noose around the mouse's neck, and he's going to take him for a walk and lay cheese along his path, which are the underage girls. And if Prince Andrew takes the cheese, and none of us believe he did, then Epstein would believe he has the family in the palm of his hand. I don't think he would have used it against Andrew for money," says someone else with insight into that December 2010 weekend. Why would he need to do that? As we know now, he had $500 million, but I do believe he would have used Andrew to rehabilitate his image, because he'd just gotten off of house arrest. The general mood in Epstein's home that weekend was jubilant. He seemed happy, the source continues. He was finally done with his sentence and was trying to get back to, if you want to use the word, his normal life. Andrew came with bragging rights. That's what Jeffrey did. He surrounded himself with high-profile people to boost his image, and Andrew was a pawn in all of that. Whether for image rehabilitation, political influence, or cold hard cash, Epstein was ready to show off his prized house guest. At 8 a.m. on Saturday, December 4, 2010, Witheridge and Donnelly began staking out Epstein's townhouse. Sometime that morning, the front door burst open, and a group of men in dark suits emerged. Witheridge heard their voices and knew. British accents, she remembers. Who else would have British royal protection agents with walkie-talkies talking into their cufflinks? Prince Andrew. Smelling blood, she phoned Mahmoud, who had been in the tri-state area on another story. "I'm 99% sure he's here. The street is full of undercover British cops," she told Mahmoud. Soon, the News of the World team had assembled on East 71st Street, Withridge and Donnelly in one SUV and Mahmoud in another. From one frigid day into the next, they sat in their cars, waiting and watching the comings and goings, Withridge recalls. First came the girls, many with roller bags, going in and out, says Withridge. The women were young, but Withridge couldn't say they were underage, because they were all wearing big puffer jackets and hoods and hats. She followed some of them. "I banged on all of those doors and tried to speak to those girls, but at that point none of them were talking. In broad daylight in busy Manhattan, two carloads of tabloid journalists were bound to be noticed by Epstein's and Andrews' overlapping security details. But one person on the stakeout had the ability to become invisible, the photographer, Jay Donnelly. Donnelly views his jobs as missions and his photographs as evidence. He learned endurance under pressure during a week of military-style training in Virginia, where he was taught extreme first aid, checkpoint training, kidnapping, being shot at by snipers, he says. With his thin physique, easy grin, and British accent, he resembles a friendly elf. But he can rise up like a cobra, his backpack a holster, in which he carries a Canon camera with a telephoto lens, firing off rounds that will live in infamy. Bang. For 3 days and nights, Donnelly disappeared on the street where Epstein lived. He says his modus operandi is to blend in and create opportunities. That magical moment when a door opens and a world exclusive walks out. Only at this moment, someone may have been watching him. On day 3 of the stakeout, the team's patience paid off. "It was very sudden. Poof," says Withridge. She heard a member of the Royal Security team say, "What if they go on a walkabout?" Then the door opened, and out came Epstein and Andrew. Royalty and specialist protection agents surrounded the pair as they walked west on East 71st Street toward Fifth Avenue. I later thought, why on earth didn't his Royal Protection Squad say, "There's a team of reporters and photographers outside," Withridge remembers. Withridge jumped into Donnelly's SUV and took the wheel, the photographer riding shotgun. "We literally took off after them," she says. At the end of 71st Street, Andrew and Epstein turned right, against the traffic on Fifth Avenue, en route to Central Park. Withridge had to turn left, while Donnelly bolted out with his backpack. He raced after them as they walked through the park. He watched as Andrew's security detail fanned out in a star shape around them, he remembers, giving the pair a wide perimeter so the two of them could speak freely. He was soon standing on a rock formation, overlooking the path the duo would soon take. And there, at approximately 1:40 p.m., on Sunday, December 5th, 2010, atop a massive mound of black Manhattan schist bedrock, Donnelly began firing off frames. Bang. There is so much we don't know about Epstein and his relationship with Andrew. They were first spotted together at a party in 2000 at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago. Other far-flung sightings, all damning but not definitive, have placed them together at parties, on planes, and in palaces. But this photograph of them alone in conversation together is indisputable evidence. On February 20, 2011, the News of the World ran the incriminating photograph under the headline, "Prince Andy and the Pedo." Without that photo, they would have the chance to deny any knowledge of knowing each other, says Donnelly, and that photo, for them, sadly exists. But had the fake sheikh and his band of bloodhounds really outfoxed the master of manipulation? Or had Epstein orchestrated the outing to be used as evidence against Andrew and perhaps even higher-ranking members of the royal family? Had the King of Stings been stung? I'm sure, says Witheridge, in a sense it suited Epstein to be pictured with Prince Andrew. He would have been told that we were outside. We weren't hiding. You couldn't hide out there. Epstein's got staff. He's got bodyguards. They would have said there are two carloads of journalists in the street. So, yes, I'm sure we were used. Donnelly's photograph went viral, eventually reaching and propelling into action a young woman on the other side of the globe. Virginia Roberts Giuffre lived in a small town on the coast of Australia, where she had moved to escape the horrors of Jeffrey Epstein. In an article published in the Mail on Sunday, on February 26, 2011, she said the picture of Andrew and Epstein in the park triggered distressing memories of events that began more than a decade earlier, when she was a troubled 16-year-old working as a $9-an-hour spa attendant at Mar-a-Lago. While working there, she would claim, she was recruited by Ghislaine Maxwell as a sex slave to sexually service Epstein and his friends, including royalty, at his home in Palm Beach, and then around the world. Giuffre told the Mail that she had three encounters with Andrew, at Maxwell's home in London in March 2001 when she was 17, Epstein's New York home later that year, and after she had turned 18 on Epstein's private island, Little St. James. In London, Giuffre said, Maxwell and Epstein had taken her to the nightclub Tramp, where she danced with Andrew, then 41. From an envelope of photographs, Giuffre showed male journalist a snapshot that would soon become infamous. It showed Andrew with his arm around young Giuffre as Maxwell grinned in the background. Giuffre said Epstein himself had snapped the photo with her disposable Kodak camera. Nevertheless, the Mail article stated, there is no suggestion that there was any sexual contact between Virginia and Andrew, or that Andrew knew that Epstein paid her to have sex with his friends. In time, however, Giuffre would add damning new details to her story. In 2015, she sued Maxwell, who'd called her a liar, for defamation. In court papers filed for the case, she claimed that Epstein forced her to have sex with Andrew when she was 17. Those statements were struck from the court record, only to come to light 4 years later, just before Epstein's death. In all, Giuffre claimed to have had sex with Andrew three times, in the bathtub at Maxwell's London home, during an orgy on Epstein's island, and at Epstein's home in New York City. Buckingham Palace denied the claims. The Queen showed support for her problem child, riding with him to Sunday church service at Balmoral the day after Epstein's death. But new and hard revelations just kept coming. One of Epstein's pilots claimed that Andrew had flown with Giuffre, then 17, to the U.S. Virgin Islands in April 2001. A woman named Johanna Schoberg said that Andrew had placed his hand on her breast while posing for a photo with a puppet of himself inside Epstein's Manhattan townhouse, also in 2001. In August 2019, the Daily Mail published a dossier by reporter Guy Adams claiming Andrew and Epstein partied together at least 20 times, even after the financier was convicted. 2 months later, the Channel 4 documentary, The Prince and the Pedophile, revealed that Epstein had 13 phone numbers for Andrew in his address book. He became so toxic, Donald Trump denied knowing him, reported the Times of London. It was coming to a point of desperation where he had to do something, says one royal correspondent. Sitting in the Café Nero beneath the shadow of the BBC's London headquarters, Emily Maitlis, then the lead presenter of the network's primetime current affairs program, Newsnight, still can't believe her historic interview with Andrew happened at all. I'm not doing Newsnight, Andrew allegedly said, in response to Maitlis and her producer Esme Wren's initial overture. That was no surprise. Newsnight is known for being tough. If you come to Newsnight, you know you're not going to be asked about puppies, right? Says Maitlis, who has interviewed everyone from Trump to the Dalai Lama. You're going to be asked the questions that people sitting at home want to hear the answers to. Andrew works out of an office on a top floor in Buckingham Palace. Surprisingly small, actually, says Maitlis. The higher up in the palace one goes, the smaller the rooms and the lower the ceilings. And Andrew's office is very high up and very small. As the Epstein scandal unfolded, this office seemed to become a kind of bubble from which it was difficult to see the realities outside the palace walls. Maitlis and her team approached Andrew through his chief of staff, Amanda Thirsk, with the offer of a no-holds-barred interview. It was a long shot, but Maitlis gamely delivered her pitch. He can make his case. We can ask all the questions that might feel awkward but are worth asking, she recalls telling Thirsk. After the meeting, the BBC team was told that Andrew was interested in an interview, but would speak only about his charitable initiatives and business interest. Maitlis and her producers declined that offer. Months passed, and the media coverage of Andrew and Epstein grew even more scathing. In the fall of 2019, the Newsnight team was invited back to the palace for a meeting with Andrew himself. They found themselves seated around a table in the prince's office, so high it seemed under the eaves of the palace, Maitlis would later remember. There, under a sloping roof, around a mahogany table, they were served tea in bone china cups bearing the royal crest of the queen. Andrew said he had just one goal, to set the record straight. He just wanted to push back through us at the newspaper coverage, says Maitlis. Andrew, it appeared, was actually considering the unthinkable, submitting to an on-camera interview without conditions. Nothing like, you can only have 10 minutes to ask me about Ghislaine and Epstein, and that's all, says one astonished royal observer. Those who opposed the interview, reportedly including Sarah Ferguson, were overruled. He's quite an earnest guy, says a source familiar with the situation, and they felt that if he could tell his version of events, people would believe him. There was just one detail that needed to be resolved before they could proceed. As Andrew put it, he had to seek approval from higher up, meaning the Queen. The next morning, Maitlis received a message. The interview was a go. To Maitlis, every interview was a conversation. Her job is to keep the conversation rolling, never expressing surprise or outrage, no matter how outrageous the answers, and always intently listening for an opening. That special moment when what she calls her journalistic muscle memory kicks in. On the afternoon of Thursday, November 14th, 2019, Maitlis was directed to one of the Queen's large ground floor ballrooms, where Andrew was waiting. Shaking everyone's hand, he seemed kind of almost excited. Soon they were sitting across from each other, bathed in harsh television lights. Maitlis remembers thinking, how am I going to do this? But then her instincts kicked in. Once you start listening to the answers, you know what comes next, she says. That's what I mean by muscle memory. It helped that Andrew was, as Maitlis later put it, unleashed, unstoppable. After a decade of silent frustration, he wanted to tell me everything. He told me things he had no need to reveal. He said he and Epstein weren't close, that Epstein was merely the plus one to his girlfriend, Maxwell, whom Andrew had known since the 1980s. He didn't stay with Epstein to party. I never have really partied, he insisted. It would be a considerable stretch to say that he was a very, very close friend, Andrew went on, but he had the most extraordinary ability to bring extraordinary people together, and that's the bit that I remember as going to the dinner parties. It was a cosmopolitan group of what I describe as U.S. eminence. Maitlis pressed him to explain his decision to visit Epstein mere months after he'd been released from house arrest. Why were you staying with a convicted sex offender? Andrew said he had gone to New York with the sole purpose of saying to Epstein that because he had been convicted, it was inappropriate for us to be seen together. That, he claimed, is what he was telling Epstein when they were photographed in Central Park. Under Maitlis' relentless questioning, Andrew admitted to flying on Epstein's plane, staying on his private island and in his home in Palm Beach, and visiting Maxwell's London home. Then, Maitlis listed the many times Andrew had reciprocated Epstein's hospitality in Great Britain, where Epstein was able to enter what she called the heart of the royal family at your invitation. At Windsor Castle, Epstein attended Princess Beatrice's 18th birthday party, posing in costume alongside fellow guest Maxwell and serial sex abuser Harvey Weinstein, and the auspicious Dance of the Decades on June 21st, 2000, commemorating Andrew's 40th birthday, Princess Anne's 50th, Princess Margaret's 70th, and the Queen Mother's 100th. We now know that he was and had been procuring young girls for sex trafficking, said Maitlis. We now know that, Andrew said. At the time, there was no indication. On and on the conversation went, finally arriving at what would be the critical juncture. The mention of the young woman who claims that at age 17, she was flown across the ocean by Epstein on his Lolita Express and paid $15,000 to dance with a prince. One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Roberts, has made allegations against you. She says she met you in 2001. She says she dined with you, danced with you at Tramp nightclub in London. She went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia, belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell, your friend. Your response? I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady, said Andrew. When Maitlis brought up the photo Giuffre said Epstein took of them together, Andrew said, I've never seen Epstein with a camera in my life. As for his hand around her waist, well, I am not one to, as it were, hug, and public displays of affection are not something that I do. He had never even been in Tramp with Giuffre, he said, and her allegations that he bought drinks at the bar proved it. I don't know where the bar is in Tramps. I don't drink. I don't think I've ever bought a drink in Tramps whenever I was there. Furthermore, on the date in question, I'd taken Beatrice to a Pizza Express in Woking for a party at, I suppose, sort of 4 or 5 in the afternoon. When Maitlis asked about Giuffre's claim that he was profusely sweating while they danced, he cited a peculiar medical condition caused by what I would describe as an overdose of adrenaline in the Falklands War when I was shot at, and it was almost impossible for me to sweat. Asked if he regretted his friendship with Epstein, the prince replied, no, still not. Because he'd made introductions and created opportunities that were actually very useful. But Andrew did admit one error. As far as Mr. Epstein was concerned, it was the wrong decision to go and see him in 2010, he said. Mr. Epstein. The name hung in the overheated Buckingham Palace air. Epstein, the seducer, the enabler, the rattlesnake, who, using the bait of money, young women, and power, had entangled Prince Andrew in his depraved world. Now, from beyond the grave, with the whole world watching, Epstein was coiled and ready to strike once again, this time eating Andy alive. Do I regret the fact that he has quite obviously conducted himself in a manner unbecoming? Yes, Andrew said. It was the opening Maitlis had spent her professional life training for, 20 years of muscle memory coming to bear upon a single calamitous word. Her response was almost automatic. Unbecoming? She said. He was a sex offender. The prince was on the ropes, his words about to pour out in a torrent. "You stayed with him," she said. "I stayed with him, and that's the bit that, as it were, I kick myself for on a daily basis, because it was not something that was becoming of a member of the royal family, and we try and uphold the highest standards and practices, and I let the side down, simple as that." After that, the hour was mercifully over. Once it was done, another surprise. The prince and his team believed it had gone well. Some even supposedly thought the interview might change the narrative of the prince and the predator. "I know he was happy with it," says Maitlis. "We ended on very good terms. I know he told his mother it had gone very well." Back at the BBC, Maitlis and Wren watched and edited the interview in stunned silence. "We just couldn't quite believe what we had," says Wren. The broadcast, titled Prince Andrew and the Epstein Scandal, aired on Saturday night, November 16th, on BBC Two. The ratings were as hot as the reactions. "No sweat and no regret," blared the Mirror headline. "I expected a train wreck," Royal Central editor-in-chief Charlie Proctor wrote. "That was a plane crashing into an oil tanker, causing a tsunami, triggering a nuclear explosion level bad." The only true thing Prince Andrew said the entire interview was that he never pays for the drinks, added former British diplomat Craig Murray. In the days following the interview, Andrew stepped down from all public duties, owing to the circumstances relating to my former association with Jeffrey Epstein, he said in a statement. 2 days after that, he and the Queen were photographed riding on horseback on the grounds of Windsor Castle, a signal that Her Majesty was still backing her storm-tossed son. "They tried to use the Queen as a protective shield," says someone familiar with the situation. In the weeks following the interview, Andrew sat in crisis meetings with his advisers, 10 or 15 men and women coming in small groups for separate issues in the Royal Lodge, says the friend. Andrew's demeanor during the meetings, one of deep, deep injustice, that this is an incredible injustice to him and his family, and therefore to his mother and the royal brand as a whole. He was very, very upset with the results and response by the public to the interview. Other alleged witnesses began coming forward to corroborate Giuffre's account. A retired palace guard, said to have put in 23 years of stellar service, told the Mail a story that seemed to blow a hole in Andrew's Pizza Express alibi. The guard recalled being on duty at Buckingham Palace after midnight on March 11, 2001, when Andrew and his bodyguard came barreling up to the gates in the prince's green Jaguar. "Open these bloody gates, you buffoons," the guard recalled Andrew shouting over his bodyguard's police radio. If I'm correct, Prince Andrew could have returned from Pizza Express or Sunninghill Park in the early evening, the guard continued. "Then he went to Tramp and Maxwell's house, which is very close to the palace, and returned to his private quarters in the early hours of the morning." The most damning response to the interview would come not in the form of headlines, tweets, or late-night television jokes. On the far coast of Australia, Giuffre was watching. To have to sit there in front of the television and have Prince Andrew not take responsibility and go on national TV and say, "She's wrong, I don't even remember her." "That's very offensive to a victim of sexual trafficking," says attorney Sigrid McCauley, who represents Giuffre and other survivors. Had Andrew shown contrition of any kind, Giuffre might have gone away. Instead, in August 2021, she filed a civil suit in the Southern District of New York, accusing the prince of sexual assault and rape in the first and third degree. On October 29th, Andrew's lawyers filed a 36-page motion for dismissal. beginning with the claim that Andrew never sexually abused or assaulted Giuffre, and going on to call her lawsuit baseless, her rhetoric lurid, and her objective nothing more than a payday. They also argued that Giuffre had waived any right to sue him by signing a broad release, negotiated by Epstein himself in 2009. In exchange for $500,000, she allegedly indemnified any and all persons who Giuffre identified as potential targets of future lawsuits. 2 months later, the judge rejected the motion, reasoning that the late pedophile likely had only been out to protect himself, as the New York Post put it. For Andrew, the rejection was devastating. He was looking into the abyss, confident that he is innocent and would prevail in the motion to dismiss, says a longtime friend of Andrew's. Now he's in the abyss. The most cataclysmic reaction came from the Queen. In February, Queen Elizabeth became the first British sovereign to celebrate a platinum jubilee, marking 70 years on the throne. Prince Charles and Prince William were said to have encouraged the Queen to take decisive action. "It's business, not personal," was Charles's view, says a royal observer, adding that the toxicity of Andrew had to be isolated from the crown. The guillotine came down hard. On January 13th, the day after Andrew's appeal was denied, Buckingham Palace issued a statement. With the Queen's approval and agreement, the Duke of York's military affiliations and royal patronages have been returned to the Queen. The Duke of York will continue not to undertake any public duties and is defending this case as a private citizen. A month later, with the indignity of a deposition looming, Andrew threw in the towel, settling out of court with Giuffre for a confidential sum, reportedly some $16.3 million, including a substantial donation believed to be $2.7 million to Ms. Giuffre's charity in support of victims' rights, a statement to the U.S. court read. The settlement prevents Andrew from even repeating his claim that he had no recollection of meeting Ms. Giuffre, reported the Telegraph. The Queen is said to have supplied most of the money, with encouragement from Charles and William. The amount of the settlement and the charitable donation tells me there was significant evidence and leverage over the prince, says Krista Ramey, a plaintiff's civil rights attorney not involved with the case. "Will he be welcomed back into the royal family?" asked the longtime friend. "He hopes so, but not a chance. It's retirement for him." Settling the case, the friend adds, is the first smart thing he has done. All That Breathe, by Mae Jong, with photographs by An Rong Shu. Last March, the Atlanta spa shootings left 8 people dead and their communities steeped in grief. But it is the victims' lives, their stories, their love, that tell a parable for a country. Opening photo, Soon Chung Park, who was killed in the spa where she worked, pictured with her husband, Guang Ho Lee, on their mantle. 1. Lion. On the afternoon of March 16, 2021, Marcus Lyon and his girlfriend dropped off their son at daycare and went out for a late lunch not far from Sixes, a suburb of Atlanta that takes its name from a collection point on the Trail of Tears. The seafood restaurant where they headed stood just south of Larry McDonald Memorial Highway, named for the Georgia politician who served as president of the John Birch Society, a Cold War-era group that viewed the civil rights movement as a communist plot. Lyon, 31, had been delivering for FedEx since November, but the past month he'd been suffering from lower back and shoulder pain. He earned $130 a day, plus a dollar for every delivery after the 110th, and no benefits. He was faster than most of his colleagues, once making 25 deliveries in an hour. But the load was wearing him out. Plus, their 4-year-old had been crawling into bed with them lately. Around 4 p.m., Lyon, off work that day, dropped his girlfriend at the bar where she worked and began driving along his delivery route, which, as usual, took him by Jung's Asian Massage in Acworth. Just before 5 p.m., he decided to go in. Inside, 44-year-old Dao Yu Feng greeted Lyon and asked if he wanted one or two girls. Lyon said one would do and paid Feng $120 in cash. She took him down a narrow hallway that ran the length of the parlor to a room on the left. Lyon took off his clothes, pulled a towel over himself, and laid face down on the massage table. Feng entered and began massaging Lyon's back. No more than a few minutes had passed when they heard a gunshot. Then a second shot rang out. Lyon dove behind the table, still undressed. Feng opened the door, and a third gunshot hit her in the head. Lyon remained hidden, waiting until the shot stopped and a doorbell quieted before he reached for his trousers and shoes. He rushed out to his car, grabbed his 9mm pistol purchased at a pawn shop 2 weeks prior, and ran back inside. 3 women, all spa workers, stood wailing. They asked Lyon to call the police and rushed out. Lyon saw another customer, Elsias Hernandez Ortiz, walking around with blood dripping from his head. That afternoon, Hernandez Ortiz had stopped by the strip mall, as he did every other week, to wire money to his family in Guatemala, where it supported 5 people. He'd been waiting for a masseuse when the shooting started. When the killer opened the door to his room, Hernandez Ortiz got on his knees, put his hands up, and asked to be spared. "Please don't shoot me. I haven't done anything. Please don't shoot. Please don't shoot." A bullet entered his face between his nose and his left eye. Because Hernandez Ortiz had been looking up, the bullet traveled through his nasal cavity rather than his brain, down his throat, lodging itself in his abdomen. After the killer left, Hernandez Ortiz found refuge in the spa bathroom. He waited there for help. Lyon called 911 and began narrating what he was seeing to the operator. Feng was dead, so was Delina Yon Gonzalez, a 33-year-old Waffle House server who'd come to the spa with her husband, Mario Gonzalez, who is from Mexico and who worked as a landscaper. Mario could only take time off in inclement weather, which is why the couple was visiting the spa as the rain began that day. Paul Andre Michels, a 54-year-old handyman there to check out a pipe, whom the workers called Lao Zheng, or Dear Mister, was dead too. Lion could see one person still breathing. It was the owner, Zhao Jitan. The 911 operator asked Lion if he could administer chest compressions. Lion, who used to be a lifeguard, declined. A few years prior, during a shooting at a FedEx warehouse in a different Atlanta suburb, a 19-year-old worker had shot six colleagues before killing himself. A FedEx employee, a certified emergency medical technician, tucked an injured security guard's organs back into his body. Later, the security guard, who had developed complications from the shooting, tried to sue his colleague, Lyon recalled. "People are crazy like that," he said. The security guard, Christopher Sparkman, had sued FedEx, not his colleague. A few minutes later, three police officers arrived. Lyon watched as they dragged Gonzalez out in handcuffs and put him in a police car where he was mistakenly detained for hours. Back home that night, Lyon felt weird sleeping next to his girlfriend and his son. He had been too close to death to lie among the living, so he got up and went to the sofa. 3 days later, Lyon was back at work, but the dull thud of boxes hitting pavement reminded him too much of gunshots, and by month's end he had quit. "I'm not going to let that happen again," Lyon told me when we met at a Dunkin' Donuts in Sixes, 10 miles north of Young's. His 9mm goes everywhere with him now, even to bed. Stone Mountain. On the other side of Atlanta, 16 miles due east, is Stone Mountain, then, as now, a Native American holy site. In 1945, Ku Klux Klan members climbed it to carve out a cross, stretching 300 feet across the mountain face. The men lit it on fire, a pharos visible 60 miles away, according to historian Kevin M. Cruz, in White Flight. Upon this sacred stone face, sculptor and KKK sympathizer Gutzon Borglin had begun exerting his will. A bas-relief of Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson, but left before finishing, moving on to his opus, Mount Rushmore. Stone Mountain is the largest shrine to white supremacy in the history of the world, as Richard Rose of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has said. Stone Mountain is also among the most visited sites in the state. On any given weekend, families host cookouts, play mini golf, and line up blithely for leisure activities against the backdrop of the Three Horsemen. 2. Feng. When Daoyu Feng was 14 or 15, or maybe 16, accounts vary, she left home, a village near Jiangjing Prefecture in China, and moved 260 miles east to Guangzhou City, near Hong Kong, where she found work at a toy factory. Feng's family was desperately poor and relied on Feng and her older brother Dao Kun, who left home when Feng was 3 or 4 to work at a rubber tree farm, where he made the equivalent of $5 a month. Another brother, Zhao Shan, whose foot was debilitated in a childhood injury, supported himself by farming. Her sister Mei, also sent away to find work in the city, had eloped with a factory worker, and so the weight of filial duty fell on the shoulders of young Feng. After working at various factories in Guangzhou and Shenzhen, Feng went to work in Shanghai. She told her family she gave facials. The year she turned 38, Feng returned to her village to find a husband. The search was unsuccessful. They tried to introduce men to her, Zhao Kun recalls, but she wouldn't even take a look. "This is not okay. That is not okay." Then an acquaintance in Shanghai helped Feng get a tourist visa to the United States. Zhao Kun mocked her. "You haven't graduated from primary school. How can you go to the United States?" In May 2016, Feng arrived in Los Angeles, a friend of a friend, an Uber driver, who also worked in construction, and whom Fing called Didi, or little brother, picked her up. She was hired at a nail salon, a restaurant, and within a few days, a massage parlor. As soon as she could, Fing, now going by the name Coco, called home from an American telephone number. No one answered, believing it was a scam. Fing rarely shared details of her life in America with her family back home. Instead, the monthly phone calls centered on the various financial needs of the extended family. Every few weeks, Fing would wire 1,500 yuan, about $230, via WeChat, a free messaging app popular in China, to Dao Quan, who would then send the money to their mother in the countryside. Over the years, Fing paid for her mother's eye surgery, her nephew's school fees, her sister-in-law's business expenses, and the weddings and funerals of relatives and neighbors. Without being asked, Fing always sent extra money for such holidays as Lunar New Year and the Dragon Boat, Mid-Autumn, and Hungry Ghost Festivals. She also paid to renovate her parents' house, as well as for the mortgage on her oldest brother's house, which he shared with his wife, his son, and his son's wife. In May 2020, Fing made a down payment on a four-bedroom apartment for her mother. At various times, Fing supported 10 members of her family. On March 14th last year, around 10 or 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Fing called Dao Quan to discuss Qingmingji, an upcoming tomb-sweeping holiday honoring ancestors. Fing would send 1,000 yuan, about $150, so the family could purchase food for the event. Two chickens, a goose, some rice, and bananas and apples for dessert, as well as ghost money made from incense paper for burning and customary firecrackers. Dao Quan was at the barbershop getting a haircut, so the call was brief. On March 15th at 10 p.m., Fing called an acquaintance, a government cadre who lived in Fing's mother's village, and helped convert the money Fing sent via WeChat into cash. He was in a meeting, and he too rushed Fing off the phone. That would be the last time anyone back home would hear from their little sister. It wasn't until 6 days after the killings that Dao Quan read what happened on WeChat. He called his sister Mei and asked her to pick up their mother, Huazhen Zhang, and bring her to him in Zhuhai City near Macau. Dao Quan wanted to protect his mother from the news, at least until he knew more. He went to the local police station, where he was given a phone number for the American Embassy in Beijing. A staffer confirmed that the anonymous Chinese woman killed at Young's Asian Massage was indeed Dao Yufeng. Dao Quan considered traveling to the United States, but his children dissuaded him from making the perilous and costly journey. The family considered repatriating Fing's body back to China, but according to an ancient local tradition, unmarried daughters who die away from home cannot be buried in their ancestral village. On April 4th, after her body lay unclaimed in the county morgue for 19 days, Fing was at last interred. Her funeral was attended by sympathetic strangers, no friends or colleagues, many of whom were asylum seekers or of otherwise precarious immigration status. On the same day, Dao Quan's wife rose at 4 a.m. to pluck the chickens before the family headed to sweep their ancestral tomb. Arriving at the gravesite, they cleaned it of wild growth and lit their ghost money on fire. Others whispered prayers to the long list of spirits who had come before, a list that now included Fing. But Dao Quan did not. "I never believed the dead could listen to the living." Next, photographs. The author's paternal grandparents, Suk Myung and Chun Ja, pose for a wedding photo on March 3, 1957, in Busan. The author's father and his maternal grandmother, Ma Bun Lee, near the Korean Broadcasting Service office in Busan in 1959. And Chun Ja, while she worked as a secretary in Busan in the early 1950s. The first migration. Chinese laborers in the South were among the earliest Asians to migrate to the U.S. from the mid to late 19th century. Anxious white plantation owners hired them during Reconstruction. The first Chinese in Georgia came as contract laborers in 1873, when an Indianapolis construction company brought in 200 Chinese workers to help build the Augusta Canal. Although Chinese labor completed much of the public infrastructure work in Georgia at this time, including railroads and bridges, according to Emory University history professor Chris Hsu, the Chinese population was scrubbed from history, subsumed into the black-white binary of the American South. These immigrants aided in the economic transition from raw extraction to something approaching industrial capitalism, as Alexander Saxton writes in The Indispensable Enemy, but were reduced to their basic economic function, treated later as high-tech coolies, says Mount Holyoke College Associate Professor Aiko Day, pointedly using the slur derived from the Tamil word coolie, as in wages. South Asian and Syrian merchants traveled across the American South into the early 20th century, hawking rugs and fabric, or chinoiserie. Then Methodist missionaries began recruiting students from Korea, Japan, and the Philippines to study at Duke, Emory, and Vanderbilt universities. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, known as Hart-Celler, ended the quota-based immigration system and specifically encouraged immigration from Asia and Africa. The Asian population in America grew from 63,000 people in 1870 to 12 million in 2000, and that number has nearly doubled since. They came to America as members of educated professional classes, who in their new country became Gujarati hotel operators, Korean shopkeepers, Vietnamese nail salon owners, and Hmong chicken farmers. 3. Tan. Before America, Zhouji Tan was the second of two daughters born to a bicycle repairman from Nanning, about 170 miles inland from Feng's hometown. Tan's family was similarly poor, and when she was 20, they married off their younger daughter to a shoe salesman. The couple had a daughter before divorcing. In the early 2000s, Tan met an American roofing businessman named Michael Webb, whom she married in 2004. 2 years later, they moved to Florida, where Tan worked at a nail salon. In 2010, they moved to Georgia, where Webb was from, and settled in Marietta, where Tan opened her own nail salon. They divorced in 2012, the same year Tan became a U.S. citizen. In 2013, she married Jason Wang, a former foreign student from northern China. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.